I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the heart of the Middle East on the USA's Malcolm X Day, celebrating the life of the assassinated black Muslim freedom fighter who transformed his fight against racism in the US to one of global working class emancipation. The world today is arguably far more dangerous and polarized than when Malcolm was born a century ago. As UK-US-EU armed genocide continues in this region, Western European collaborators like Estonia's Kaja Kallas meet in Brussels and UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer in London hosts European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Their concerns are united with their desire to continue the proxy war in Russia through Ukraine, regardless of the threat of nuclear war. Donald Trump has arguably been open about the need to exploit poorer countries when once NATO nation leaders lied about largesse to disguise their motives with humanitarian platitudes and aid. One of the greatest truth tellers about the use of aid and the slaughter propagated by the IMF and World Bank published the first edition of his bestseller Confessions of an Economic Hitman some 21 years ago. Joining Going Underground again from Bainbridge Island in the U.S. state of Washington is former U.S. economic hitman John Perkins. John, thanks so much for coming back. I know you've been critical of Donald Trump, who's just been visiting this region, to much applause and support, arguably. I mean, he said he wanted to take the Panama Canal. He's trying to take all the energy resources of Syria. But the difference to a U.S. Elite trying to take resources in your book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is he's open about it. You don't find that refreshing?
Sure. And, you know, some of the policies that he's implemented, I approve of. But what really concerns me is I think that what Trump is trying to do is become basically a dictator. You know,
he was elected, John. Come on. He was elected overwhelmingly.
Yes, and I just came back from Guatemala, where they, not too long ago, had what they call an auto coup. And an auto coup is when a legitimately elected president then decides that he doesn't ever want to leave that office. And so starts taking out all the military leaders that might oppose them and putting in ones that he likes, does away with habeas corpus, that does away, really tries to undermine the legal system and the press and the universities. And my fear is that that's exactly what Trump is in the process of doing, is exactly that same sort of thing, that they're using that as a model.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, it's particularly to do with those protesting the genocide in Gaza. You've said that Israel plays the part, basically, of our armed fortress in the middle of Arab oil fields. I'm sure you don't particularly like the New York Times, the propaganda paper, but when you get Thomas Friedman, an appalling neocon columnist saying this Israeli government is not a U.S. ally, do you sense that whilst at home you can't protest or you can have thought crimes if you sympathize with the plight of Palestinians, on the wider geopolitical stage, Trump is actually doing something. He's not prolonging the genocide, as we now know, genocide Joe really was. New leaks showing that at no time did Biden try to get Israel to stop their mass slaughter of women and children.
Yeah, well, this is something that's recently happened. I like to see what he's doing in terms of apparently siding somewhat with the Palestinians, with the people of Gaza, and trying to put pressure on Netanyahu. It needs to put a lot of pressure on Netanyahu, but it still remains to be seen what really will come out of all this. Because I also think a motivating factor for him being in the Middle East is to enrich him and his family. He's striking all kinds of deals there that will help him and his family. I apologize for my cat.
No, you've got the new the newly new Kash Patel cat, presumably, checking on you about your accusations of corruption. I mean, we all know about the allegations of corruption against previous U.S. presidents. And of course, Trump companies will do well. But are you not being short-sighted in attacking the man, the individual here, when I think most importantly, in the context of your work, is his destruction of USAID? Because your book is full of implications and concrete examples of the terrible, terrible nature of humanitarian aid from the United States, what it's really about. I mean, didn't you not throw a party when you heard what Trump was doing to USAID? I've seen it all around the developing world, what USAID has done.
Yeah, there's two perspectives here. One is the perspective of what USA and other foreign aid does to the countries that it exploits, and it does exploit these other countries. And that's what I've opposed in my books and spoken out against. That was my job. But right now, if you look at it from the standpoint of the United States and Trump's idea of making America great again, getting rid of U.S. foreign aid and USAID plays right into the hands of China. And so we're in this period of time where the Chinese empire is increasing, the American empire is becoming more isolationist. And so it all depends on the perspective. Yeah, I think from the perspective of not exploiting, developing countries so much, getting rid of AID is really good. But from the perspective of doing what Donald Trump says he wants to do, which is to make America great again, withdrawing into an isolationist kind of a perspective totally opens the door for China to move in more strongly. And China's been doing a great job of moving in more strongly on its own prior to Trump. There's no question about it. But I think this feeds into their hands.
I mean, that's more severe than even Professor John Mersheimer from the University of Chicago, friend of the show. He comes on this show a lot, and he has a very realist view of international relations, one of the great experts on international relations. On the other hand, you're in Washington State, and you've seen the destruction of infrastructure over successive administrations. All that money being poured out for your soft power at the expense of the American people. Isn't that the point that resonates so much with the U.S. working class and why Trump won?
Yeah, there's no question. In the United States, we've been very, very dissatisfied with all the previous administrations, and perhaps especially with the Biden administration. There was a great deal of dissatisfaction, and a lot of it was very justified. But again, I'll go back to my concern of what I've seen in these, first few months of the Trump administration is a real attempt to undermine the democracy in this country. And that really concerns me. It's not about Trump. It's not about an individual. It's about that I really, really believe in democracy and I'm not being very democratic with the cat. And it concerns me when we see a new oligarchy evolving. And right now, Trump is in the Middle East with with the CEOs of many of the major high-tech companies, some of the wealthiest people in the world. And he's striking deals that are going to make them wealthier and make him wealthier. I don't think that's what this country should be about. I think it's great to protect, to step in and defend the Palestinians and Gaza, but to step in also and to exploit that situation to win over the trust and business relationships with the Saudis is not acceptable.
The rest of the world doesn't care so much about the civil liberties within the United States, obviously. Most of the people of the world don't live in the United States. I mean, I suppose I should really ask whether you, and I think you might be doing some forum in Las Vegas soon with Trump's son. Do you feel that people like Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence and so on, have read your work? And in a sense, the abolition of USAID and the anti-globalist agenda, as they call it, has partly been informed by your work. And even as you criticize the Trump administration for civil liberty abuses at home, obviously.
That's always an interesting question. When Osama bin Laden was captured and executed, the New York Times published a picture of his bookshelf, and there were 33 books on it, and mine was one of them. So do I take credit for what Osama bin Laden did? The guy who recently assassinated the president of the United Healthcare in the United States, he cited my book as one of his influences. But Matt Damon loves my work, too. And I think, you can go on and on and on. Do I take credit for what the other people have done? I don't know. I don't take credit for it. I do know I don't take credit for it. Should I? Maybe. But the fact of the matter is, I write about what I believe the United States has been about and was about during my time as an economic hitman and since then. And people can interpret that however they will interpret it and take actions depending on how they foresee this. But ultimately, constantly, my constant theme is we must move away from what I call a degenerative death economy that's polluting and consuming itself into extinction and into a life economy that pays people to clean up pollution, to create a better world, to move from short-term materialism to long-term benefits for life. And to stay within a democratic framework in the United States. And my concern right now is that the way we're moving is not toward a life economy, and it's not toward democracy. It's away from it. And that's not new. That's not new with Trump. It's been going on. That's what I write about all the time.
Yeah, but you see, most of us thought that, I talked to some of the people implicated by the attempts to destroy Trump's first term. And it was the Biden administration that was spreading lies about Donald Trump being a Russian spy and all of this kind. The anti-democratic forces were your head of the FBI and head of the CIA. It's those that were against democracy. Trump is bringing back democracy, so Trump supporters would say. And that was reflected in the popular vote after all the propaganda in your so-called mainstream media.
Well, the Trump was elected. Yes, that was a democratic movement. Since then, I think he's done an awful lot to get rid of democratic institutions, our legal system, our Justice Department, our educational system. You know, sending people off to El Salvador prisons because they speak out in favor of the Palestinians. That's not a democratic movement. Getting rid of habeas corpus, I mean, that's really declaring martial art, not martial law. It's the equivalent of declaring martial law. And if a country, like I came from Ecuador recently, where the president declared martial law, well, in a way, that's kind of what's happening here. And I'm very concerned about that. That's all I can say. Yes, he was democratically elected, but I'm not sure that many of the people who elected him are very happy with what he's doing now. A lot of them are, but I also know quite a few that are not.
Yeah, fascists, of course, have been elected in the past.
And you know, it's only been a few months, so we'll have to see what happens. I mean, I'm not trying to judge Donald Trump's presidency by these 3 months. What I am doing is expressing concern. I think one of the most important things of democracy is to constantly evaluate and criticize. And if you see something that you think is going awry, you talk about it, you point it out, and see what happens. And I think that's very important to do, which is what I've done most of my life since I was an economic hitman and continue to do, is to try to really look at what's going on and criticize it so it can hopefully foster some change.
John Perkins, I'll stop you there. More from the best-selling author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the best-selling author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins. John, you're making me sound like a MAGA Republican all out there with the hat there as I defended Trump against any charges of being anti-democracy. But as you said, the civil liberties implications of some of his policies are concerning. On the other hand, when you talk about Silicon oligarchs, the kind of people that were brought to on his Middle East tour, I mean, wasn't it inherent in capitalism? This is late capitalism. It always goes towards monopoly power. Regulators usually get bought off. And we're just living that natural stage of oligarch late capitalism. It's not a case of this is something new and unsurprising, what we're living through, the concentration of wealth and power in your country as the masses go hungry tonight. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands rely on the food stamp program tonight in Washington State, let alone in the United States.
Yeah. You know, we've had these swings, and at the end of the 1800s, we were in a similar situation, you know, with the golden age of the robber baron, so to speak. And that was ended. It happened again, and you know, it caused a depression in the late 20s and 30s. So we've had these swings, and we're in one now where there's a huge rise in a new class of oligarchs. I don't like to see it, and I don't think it is part of capitalism. It's part of what I call predatory capitalism. But true capitalism encourages competition, not monopolies.
You're an idealist. You're still an idealist about all this, despite what forces in the United States do who say it's a means to an end, right? Because I mean, all the people you
I grew up during a time in the 50s and 60s, and when we were seeing and in the 70s too, when we were seeing that the United States was growing increasingly toward democracy and not the predatory type of capitalism. I believed at the time, and I still believe it as you look back historically. But we've made that swing again to a very dangerous situation where wealth in this country and globally is concentrated in a very few hands. And, you know, who knows what those few hands are going to do with it. And we're at this period of time where AI, Bitcoin, and all these, all of these things that we come together, they're tools. They can be used for good or they can be used for bad. But it's a danger when they're concentrated in a few hands. And that's what's happening today. We're seeing the high tech industry is concentrated in a few hands. And this current administration seems to be supporting that movement. I hope that'll change. I want to be clear. I'm pretty apolitical. You know, I've never supported a political candidate. And I'm not trying to come down hard on the Republicans or Trump. But I am saying that what I've seen in these first few months of his administration is a movement in a direction that concerns me. And so I speak out against it, hoping that it will move in a different direction. And I still have that hope. And I think sometimes we see signs that it is. As you mentioned earlier, the very fact that Trump is standing up to Netanyahu is, I think,
to a degree. We shouldn't over-egg that too much. But of course, one of the great things about this over-concentration of wealth is it inspires new movements. You mentioned Guatemala in part one, and of course the CIA-backed destruction of the Arbenz regime gave us Che Guevara, who was inspired by it. You said you've been in Latin America recently. I mean, we on this program did one of the first interviews of President Lula when he was released from prison. He's back there in Brazil as the president. I know things aren't so good in Ecuador. Rafael Correa has been on this show. He's in exile in Belgium. But don't you see that the results of increased concentrations, and I should say decreasing concentrations in the rest of the world as BRICS movements and geopolitical movements range against the IMF and the World Bank that you wrote so articulately about, it's actually a good time?
You bring up an incredibly important point. Yes, Latin America has completely gone to China now. It's the number one trading partner, I believe, of all the Latin American countries. Colombia was the holdout until very recently, but now Colombia just in last week signed a deal to be part of the new Silk Road. But every other country in Latin America has gone to China, as has most of Africa and the world.
Do you mean go to China, or do you mean become sovereign and away from the Monroe Doctrine? I mean, from your book, you'd never think you wanted American hegemony, and that was your main ambition. Those countries would say, no, we're not part of China. We're part of BRICS. We're part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. I know it has Shanghai in the name. We're not part of China as we once were vassal states of the United States.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you know, I'll make a lot of enemies in the United States, and I do when I say these kinds of things, but I think China may actually offer some of the solution to some of the problems, because it does offer an alternative. So if countries are upset with the way the United States is dealing with them, as countries in Latin America, where I spend a lot of time, are upset with the way the United States has dealt with them, they can turn to China. It's leverage. And it doesn't mean they have to accept China as a sovereign nation over them or as a colonial power over them. I do believe that to some degree that's China's motive. Like all empires, and China's a growing empire, like all empires, China's real desire is to collect resources from these countries.
They always deny that, when we have Chinese officials and experts on, they say, look, we want mutual prosperity. We're not like the capitalist empires of old.
Yes. Yes, they've been brilliant as economic hitmen. You know, I taught in an MBA program in Shanghai, and you know, I realized that why I was there was because those students wanted to learn what it would be to be a successful economic hitman. They wanted to learn
well,
from
how
the
to do it. No, they were surely learning of the evils of the imperial United States. Don't you think?
And they've done a great job. They don't need to be militaristic in taking over countries. Yes, you're right. They haven't built military bases in other countries, except with a few exceptions. Whereas the United States has military bases in over 100 other countries, which causes resentment. And so we've really played into China's hands in that way. And China's economic hitmen have also done a very good job of exploiting the mistakes that we've made and emphasizing the tremendous success that China's had. You know, it brought it over 900 million people out of dire poverty. It had 10%, around 10% economic growth for 30 years.
And they don't go around killing people, like you say in your book, the World Bank and IMF implicated in killing people. China doesn't do that. It says it wants mutual programs and doesn't want to, I mean, unless you have any evidence for that.
Yes, but it's still building that empire that's about exploiting. Now you said that
it's like efficient. It's supposed to be mutual, isn't it? The trade. And that's the difference between the IMF and the World Bank.
I love the fact that you said that Chinese officials on your program deny that. Well, what do you expect them to do?
Some of them, people can watch our interview with Eric Li, the great venture capitalist, who said, look, I'm a capitalist. I'm not in the Communist Party, but we know in our country, policy changes, the party remains the same. In so-called democracies, the party changes and policies always stay the same. You know, and they talk about democracy in a different way. We're running out of time. I want to get to your environmentalism because clearly Trump doesn't care for it. And actually, all that stuff about environmentalism from Western Europe, while they fought wars on the NATO war in Yugoslavia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, the list goes on. They didn't seem to care about the emissions or the appalling pollution caused by their wars, let alone the deaths and destruction. Do you think it's more important to stop the wars at the moment? I mean, the Ukraine war narrowly, hopefully Trump and Putin can work something out about that proxy war. That is the worst threat to our existence, not the environment, because we came too close to nuclear war.
Yeah. Well, certainly nuclear war is a huge threat to her, But, you know, the two things are, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to say, you know, we better stop wars and keep destroying our atmosphere and our water and our soil? No, I don't think it's an either-or situation. Let's stop the wars and let's stop polluting the planet. Let's do both of these things. And, you know, it's very interesting to me that I have a 17-year-old grandson who's very, very smart, gets all A's, and I talk to him, I talk to other young people. They tell me that their greatest fear is not nuclear war, it's not climate change, it's AI, that AI is taking their jobs. So we've got another whole sector there. You know, there's these things that we're dealing with right now. This is an incredible time in human history. It's a time of perhaps the most severe challenges that we've ever faced because we're facing these challenges on a global level. You know, it's not regionalized anymore. It's so global. And at the same time, we have incredible opportunities to redefine what it means to be human beings, being human on this incredible planet. But yeah, we got to get out of this warlike mentality that seems to be part of our DNA, but we must change that. And at the same time, we must respect the fact that we live as part of nature, not apart from nature. We're not superior over nature. We can't just constantly use all of these resources and pollute the planet regardless of the consequences. We've got to think in terms of those consequences in the long term. We've got to think in terms of our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And that involves ending wars, and it involves ending the incredible pollution that we're causing and ending what you know, I like to call a degenerative death economy that focuses on tearing up resources and short-term profits regardless of the environmental and social consequences. And we have an alternative. You know, and we're seeing it with wind and solar and electric cars. We're seeing a movement of people understanding that we must.
You sound like an advert for Elon Musk, you know, one of the oligarchs he writes about, because he, of course, fears AI, too. I just got to finish by asking you, what about the American worker then in the face of oligarch capitalism? I mean, I don't. You're in Washington State. Isn't Boeing there? We have here U.S. Saudi Arabia link, Inc. massive $142 billion arms agreement. I think the biggest order for Boeing ever came from Qatar from these visits. The American worker and the American disenfranchised and the old and the sick in your country, when are they going to come together and try and seek some redress of this balance of power? As you live in feudalism, actually, it looks more like than capitalism.
I just want to point out an irony before I answer that of Qatar. But, you know, I was just recently there and interviewing in Doha and buying all these planes from Boeing. And yet the president of the United States has to receive a gift from Qatar of his own Boeing airplane. I mean, I just love the imagery of all of that. But in any case, I think the American worker today is suffering and doesn't understand, knows that he's suffering. But that was one of the reasons that he thought that by bringing Trump into power, would help the American worker. Whereas in fact, I think it's ultimately going to hurt. I don't believe the sanctions are going to put us in a stronger position. They will make things cheaper in this country. We'll produce more in this country. But in the rest of the world, Chinese goods will become cheaper because our goods will become more expensive for export. So I think there's a lot going on here that is really devastating for the American worker, and in many respects, the average American. The poor are getting rid of things, or attempting to get rid of things like Medicaid and these food subsistence programs. I think this country can do better than that.
John Perkins, thank you.
It's been my pleasure, Afshin. I always enjoy being on your show. It's wonderful. Thank you so much.
And that's it for the show. Perkins' new novel, Message from Pleiades, is out now. Our continued condolences to those suffering the impact of the US-UK-EU armed genocide in Gaza. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new episode. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.